At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to The Smiley Show, and we have a very special guest joining us today, Ian Baker Finch, who, in very recent golf news, of course, he's broadcasted golf from 1998 until this year, 2025, signed off for the final time for CBS at the Wyndham Championship a couple weeks ago. Ian, of course, won the 1991 Open Championship, is a two-time winner on the PGA Tour, and has a new book out. It's called To Hell and Back, which is, of course, a reference to the struggles he had on tour in the years following that Open win. Really excited to kind of get some, you know, stories and insights, and the two of you sharing, you know, maybe not exactly parallel paths, but just what you both experienced in the game and how you overcame that and then moved on to broadcasting. And we're going to do that, Smiley, with the help of our good friends at Ahead on the trust-based relationships front. Ahead builds and manages digital platforms that power the most successful organizations in the world. Their consultative approach, unmatched engineering, and innovative solutions combine to accelerate the impact of technology and every client they serve. Ahead's longstanding relationships are built on outcomes and experience with both their clients and technology partners. You can learn more at ahead.com. So, Smiley, what are you looking forward to discussing with Ian?
Well, it's really a pleasure to get to talk to Ian for a considerable amount of time. He's just, you know, he's done so much in this game. You know, he's played the game at the highest level. He's called golf for as many years as you just talked about, since 98. And he's just been a voice that you just, it's comforting, right? You know, it's the voice that you've always known. And any person that I've ever gotten an opportunity to meet Finchy in person, he's so good at just giving people their time and just making everybody feel important. I think that's the long lasting impact he'll have as a person. And of course, a legendary career on the golf course and then off as well. So for me, I always love the impersonation of Ian Baker Finch here. Love doing that from spring break. It was kind of my go-to. But
it was Ian and Kurt Byram, right? Like you had those guys nailed. Is that right?
More so Ian Baker Finch. I remember Kurt. I didn't even really know Kurt that well. And Kurt's like my mentor now. And so we laugh about it all the time. And I was like, man, why'd you throw me under the bus? Like he thought I was like throwing Kurt's name out because it was, you know, just for whatever reason, he was just always upset I use his name, but it's funny.
I'd forgotten that piece of it. So we got to get Ian's take on your Spring Breakers broadcasting. This is going to be a really fun one, a cool one. It's going to touch on a lot of different things. So I will waste no more of your time. We'll get you right to Smiley's conversation with Ian Baker Finch.
All right, welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. We have a guest that I'm thrilled about today with Ian Baker Finch joining the show. And Ian, first off, congratulations on an incredible career in broadcasting. You've been somebody I've looked up to for a very, very long time. So first off, congrats.
Thank you very much, Smiley. Great to be on with you. You're doing a fantastic job there. So it's the young guys like you and Colt, Amanda on the CBS side. I mean, that's what it's all about now. You know the players so well, and you're doing a fantastic job.
Yes, and it was such a great send off watching CBS what they how special it was over the last couple of weeks. It there wasn't a dry eye, it seemed like, in the compound or in that booth
at
the
Wyndham
Championship.
Well, oh my God,
it was a beautiful send off, and of course. Yeah,
I was underprepared. I had no idea. Salah Shai is our producer. He does a great job. He's turned it around. It really is amazing, the pictures we put out and the production quality. It's really special. And he said, hey, you be ready. This is going to be a couple of weeks of celebrating you, you know. So I still had no idea that the tributes would be the way they were. And as you could tell from my response at the end, when they kept showing all these old photos.
Oh, that got me in. Oh, I can't imagine how you felt. On,
she's crying her eyes out, and I'm like, oh, stop. Anyway.
Oh, it was incredible and very, very well deserved after an incredible career in broadcasting. But one of the things that have recently come out for you is a biography to Hell and Back, talking about your story in the game of golf, written by Jeff Saunders. And I want to first kind of get into this because for most part, and when we have players on this podcast that have come on, we always detail, their history in where they got started in the game and their journey. And there's no better read, I imagine, than this book that I'm super excited about reading, because I think there's going to be so many things that I read from your journey that I'm going to be able to relate to from my own personal journey in the game of golf. So when did this book come about with Jeff and wanting to get something down on paper for everybody to read?
For a long while now. I'm 65 at the end of the year. I've been involved in the game. I left school at 15 years of age to be a golf pro. That's all I ever wanted to be. I wanted to be a club pro, giving lessons, helping people out in the club. I came from a very small town, a rural area where the nearest golf course was 6 or 7 miles away. My dad and the farmers in the area did it all by voluntary labor, built the course. So that's really where I came from and what I wanted to do. I just became a good player along the way through my effort and wanting to be as good as I could be. I think a lot of players, as you said, come from that type of background where it's a singular game, as you know. It's a lonely game at times. It's not as lonely as being an Olympic swimmer, for example, but it's a lonely game. You need to be willing to put the effort in, and you've got to have a passion, as you know, to do that. So the book starts out with that, and then it ends up where I played well. Then it goes through the phase where I didn't play so well, and then the last 20, 30 years doing the TV. So it's a long-term read about my life in golf, about an era in golf, if you will, not just about me. It's not like I throughout the book.
Right.
And I'd always been asked to do this book because of my rise in golf and then seemingly my sudden demise in the game when I lost my confidence and was injured and couldn't play well anymore, or certainly couldn't compete. So I'd always kind of put it on the back shelf. I didn't really want to do it. Journalists had asked me a lot of times, come on, you should tell your story. And then I finally met Jeff about 3 years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and he came to me and he'd written a book on my great friend and mentor, Peter Thompson, and also on Sir Bob Charles, a New Zealander that also won the Open Championship back in 63. And he said, I'd like to tell your story. And he convinced me over time. He wrote a couple of chapters, sent them to me. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but
no.
Basically, he convinced me that this story needed to be told for my family, for my grandchildren. They want to look back on this and say, wow, that's what Grandpa did. So that's where it started. And we spent basically 2 years either from the States to New Zealand and Australia on some sort of format, voice, audio, this way, podcast style at time. And then when I came back to Australia for 3 months each year, we'd just sit down at the coffee shop at seven in the morning for a couple of hours, and we'd tape interviews, and we got lots of stories. And so that's basically why we did it. I trusted Jeff. He's done an amazing job of writing this book. And I'm really a part of the book, a part of an era in golf, and my journey's being told. So it's very proud of it. The editors wanted to cut it down to about 80 or 90,000 words, which seems to be what sells the best these days. We cut about 30 or 40,000 words of stories out of the book.
Wow.
We might have to write another one, actually, just on TV, because
I mean, there's so many stories from that, I imagine.
Oh, my God. We could do a podcast for 5 hours just on you, me, Colton, David Faraday. So anyway, it was a real cathartic journey through the last, 40, 50 years in golf for me.
Well, I'm very excited to read it. As much as I'm on airplanes, I'm always trying to find a new book to read. So I'm super excited to read this biography and to hell and back. So very, very happy for you.
Thank you.
And it beginning published. So go check it out. And, we had Jason Day on this podcast, and I think his story and how he grew up in Australia and just his journey to wanting to be one of the world's best, his mentor, or I should say the person that he looked up to the most was Tiger Woods. He had posters of Tiger Woods in his room, wanting to one day become world number one. And when I think about, players or juniors that grow up in a different country, and finding inspiration from whether it be a player or somebody that is the national hero for you, I read that it was Jack Nicklaus. And was that because of how great he was, or was it something? Was it his book that he put out that you drew inspiration from?
Yeah, it was. Jack was number one. Growing up, I was born in 1960, and through the 60s. Television was really just kicking off, and sports on television was just kicking off. And they had this show in the late 60s, early 70s called The Big Three. So it was Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and Gary Player, all managed by Mark McCormick. And they traveled around the world. Then there was the Shell's Wonderful World of Golf as well. And Peter Thompson and Gary Player were on that one time, playing at Royal Melbourne. Eventually, there was a show in Great Britain with Peter Allis, Lee Trevino played.
Beautiful.
That was another show that was just so fantastic, celebrity sportsmen versus celebrities. So we watched a little bit of golf here and there, but it was Jack and his book that really inspired me the most. Arnold Palmer inspired my dad and a lot of the other farmers in the area, because Arnold Palmer legitimized golf to the blue-collar worker, to the farmer, to the average man. He had the cigarettes. He had the big biceps. He had his swashbuckling style, right? Everyone loved Arnie. He was the king. So they decided that they'd start building a golf course in the late 60s because there was nothing in the area, nothing within 20 miles. So they got a land grant and decided to build a golf course. Then I got this book, Jack Nicklaus, Golf My Way, and it became my Bible. It became, that was golf. That's how I had to do it. And I think a lot of guys my age, like for you guys, it was Tiger. Tiger changed the game more than anyone else in the history of the golf. He has made golf the way it is now. You should all be paying him 10% of your earnings. And it was the same for us with Jack and Arnie. We should have been paying them 10% of our earnings, because they changed the game. They made golf popular for the masses. So that book that Jack wrote, Nick Faldo, Greg Norman, a whole bunch of guys, they're a bit older than me, but our era from the 60s and then the early 70s, that was the book that we all, basically taught ourselves. I had a little 9-hole sand scrape course with no bunkers, just a fun little farm course, basically. That's turned into a beautiful golf course now, Biewa Golf Club on the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, spectacular public golf course. It was the only way I could learn the game, really, was to try and – I'd put an iron over – I'd open the book up and I'd have an iron over each page to stop it from blowing around, and I'd work on one thing, and then the next day I'd work on the next thing. And
so it was instructional?
Yeah, it was if you look it up, Golf My Way, it was really just a picture of Jack and lots of images, lots of drawings, and lots of rendered photos of Jack and how he did it. But yeah, it was.
Was that your teacher? Instructional piece of how you learned the game?
Yes, 100%.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And to think all the things that juniors have at their disposal now, and here Ian Baker Finch is reading Jack's biography or his instructional book, like it's the only way, and that's so cool.
And then through, you know, each birthday I get another book. You know, I got one on Lee Trevino on strategy. There was one Raymond Floyd did that I really enjoyed about the competitive side of golf, but that's all we had. It was just a regular book. We didn't have, you know, Ledbetter, Harmon style coaching until the late 80s. Mm. There was really nothing around before the mid 80s that I'd read an article. A friend of mine ran a newspaper business, a news agent, we call it in Australia, and he would cut out stories that David Ledbetter and other great coaches put out in Golf Magazine or Golf Australia Digest, those sorts of things. And he would send me these in the mail wherever I was traveling playing golf. He'd send me these articles and he'd say, this is what you got to do, you know. And that was basically how we taught ourselves to play even then, even in the 80s.
Do you think there's almost like a lack of feel now for what junior players are growing up in an era of teaching where you have all of this information that it almost overcomplicates the game to where when you were playing it, it sounds like it was a very, you know, not a whole lot of thought besides just, all right, let's get the grip right, read some books, learn some strategy from Lee Trevino and go enjoy the game and have fun.
100%. And we'd have our scorecard. We'd go to a golf course to a tournament. We'd have our scorecard and we'd write down on each hole. We'd pace out. We'd get to our drive and we'd look for something on either side of the fairway. And we'd say pine tree lined up with white stake on the right. And we'd pace it out 152. So I had one thing on each hole on my scorecard. That was my yardage book. So it was, you know, sprinkler head center right of fairway number three, you know, it was 145. That was our yardage book. And I'd put on it probably 3 wood from this tee, you know, things like that. That was all we had. That's how simple it was. Yeah, it was amazing. Jack was really the first guy to do that. Wasn't anybody before Jack that actually took notes and had a little detailed yardage book or even just a scorecard with notes. Everyone used to just go by, hey, I hit 7-iron here yesterday. It looks like 155, whatever. Jack was slow when he first started, and that was one of the reasons why. He was a lot more detailed. Mm. He was very smart. He was one of the first guys to really do a lot of things and why he was so good.
Well, I think about this conversation I had with Ben Crenshaw this year, talking about Augusta National and just all the stories that he has around the property. But one of the things that stuck out was he said, you know what, to this pin, we used to just talk about, yeah, it was a 7-iron to this hole. It was an 8-iron to this hole. And he's like, yeah, we didn't use yardage books. We didn't use numbers. We just used clubs and based it off feel. And it just, I mean, Ian, you know, we're in a day and age where it's almost, we need decimal points for how exacting these players want to be. So it was so refreshing to hear just the natural feel that you had to play the game with in your era.
Do you have a minute to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
It is so annoying to me on television. I've been watching it for 30 years and it's got worse and worse and worse. How can you hit the shot in 40 seconds if the caddy talks for 2.5 minutes? It is so annoying to me. Shut up. It's 110 yards. It's a gap wedge. Don't be long because it's too fast down the hill. Like, you come to a par 3 tee and they take 2 minutes talking to each other on a par 3. You played the par 3 the last 3 days. You know it's a 5-iron to the back pin. It's a 6-iron to the front pin. Choose a club. Get out of the way. Let me hit the shot. It's so annoying to me that golf has become, from a 4-hour game, by the way, I play in 3 hours with my buddies, to a 5.5-hour game, and it's acceptable. Now, I know there's a lot of reasons, and there's probably a lot of caddies listen to this later and say, oh, Finch, you don't know what you're talking about. We've got to walk back 100 yards to the back tee every time. And I agree with that. Golf has become ridiculously slow and laborious, and that pros have to walk back 100 yards to the back tee. So there's an extra 200 yards per hole. So that's 3,600 yards extra they got to walk to what we would walking off the green to the regular tee. So I understand a lot of that. But the detail and the the wind's out of the right. I don't need to spend a minute talking about the fact that it's coming out of the right.
Right.
7.5 mile an hour. And on Thursday, it was 8.5 mile an hour. So that's an extra half a yard different. Like, the player knows it's an 8 iron with a little draw, mm-hmm. or it's a hold up 7 iron. Why does it take so long?
I don't know. That's a great question. Well, you know what? Another Jack Nicklaus note that comes to mind mm-hmm. is that I think that players are constantly always trying to figure out how to prepare for majors the correct way. And Jack Nicklaus has come on, whether it be the memorial where he's talking about stories on how he used to prepare for the Open Championship, how he'd get there earlier than everybody else, play the course in all the different winds that it may present from a span of 7 days. And it just kind of reminds me of how players overcomplicate the game at times, where Jack would just go play, figure out the different winds, and from there be able to kind of get a feel of how the golf course plays. And I think there's plenty of really high level players now that could probably use that advice. And instead of going it on your range before a major championship and hitting 1,000 golf balls, like it's not that complicated.
It's different, isn't it, now?
Yeah.
And in defense of the players, they're just doing what everyone's done, you know, the last couple of decades. They spend more time in the gym now. Because it's all about speed and how far you can hit it. That's, you know, 95% of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's that we never used to do. We'd stretch in the morning or ride a bike for half an hour to warm up, something like that 40 years ago. Peter Thompson, my great mentor, I'd say, what did you do to stay fit and strong? He said, well, I walked, of course. So he'd go on long walks. That's all he had to do in his mind. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I don't get the, hey, I'm playing 9 holes on Tuesday afternoon and 9 holes Wednesday morning in preparation for a major. I just don't, I don't get it. But they're talking about saving our energy. We've got to stay on our gym schedule, all of that sort of stuff. Whereas really in a major, get to know the course, especially an Open Championship or even say the US Open where the rough's so thick and the greens are so fast. Get to know the course. Get to know where not to hit it. I'm with you. I could never play a tournament without at least 2 full practice rounds.
And you know what's even gotten worse, Ian, is practice rounds at these big events. It's these players know how long it takes to play 9 holes. The U.S. Open this year, it took, I would say, close to 6 to 6.5 hours to play 18 holes if you teed off at around 10 a.m., It's just ridiculous how long it takes players to get around a golf course and prepare to try every single shot.
I 100% agree. But you know what? That's up to the people running the tournament. They should just say, guys, it's a 4.5 hour day today. It's 2.5 hours max per nine. You can hit, if you hit the green, you can only hit one ball. Back in my day, if there was people out there, the rules officials, if we hit a ball on the green in a practice round, we were not allowed to hit another shot. You could only hit a second shot from the fairway to the green if you didn't hit the green on the first one.
That's the Augusta rule now. That's the only place it applies.
Well, that's where it should be everywhere, right?
Yeah.
One ball. And if you want to go and just play 9 holes in 3.5 hours, you have to go after 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you have to play the front nine because everyone's still finishing their back nine of their round. Mm-hmm. Just make some rules. They could do it if they wanted to.
Yeah, but definitely
so. Where are the players going to go play? You know? Anyway.
That's a great question.
I'm retired now. I can be a little bit more honest on things like that.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your professional career because I want to work up until where you feel like your game kind of let you down. But leading up to that, from going from Australia all the way over to the PGA Tour and playing over in the States, how difficult was that adjustment for you coming over here and being away from home?
Travel in general was what Australians and New Zealanders, South Africans, of course, the Southern Hemisphere, we've always had to travel because we haven't had the money or the big events or the big tours to really prosper. The Australian Tour is a fantastic tour. It taught me the game. I played there for years before I did travel. So you get used to traveling. All sportsmen in the Southern Hemisphere have to travel to the Northern Hemisphere for the summer to be able to perform and compete. So we got used to traveling, and we're good travelers. I played in Asia first, then Europe, then Japan, and I had with my wife, Jenny, who's been with me since 1984, we decided that when we started traveling, that when we decided to have kids, that we would play the US tour because it was easier to travel in the US. They had creches first time, you know, they had food in the locker rooms. They had cars given to us. I still remember I played the Memorial Tournament in 85 and I got a Trans Am Pontiac. I'm lined up, I'm 24 years of age, and someone gives me a red Trans Am Pontiac to drive for the week. I'm like, I am in heaven. What's going on? So all of it, Nicholas was sponsored by Pontiac. So anyway, we just got used to having to travel and live out of a suitcase. Mm. And Jenny traveled with me. And then when we decided to have kids, Haley was born in February of 89. Late 88, I went over and played three or four tournaments in the US. I got my card, nearly won the World Series, bogeyed the last two holes to lose by a shot. Realized that I was good enough now to come over. Mm-hmm. So we came over in end of February of 89 and lived over in the States since then. So the US was a lot easier to travel. Elsewhere in the world, it was difficult, and you wouldn't want to have a family on the road there. Mm. In those days, it was much easier here. You just get used to it, Smiley.
Sure.
It's not like we were jumping on wheels up and flying home private. We were jumping on sitting down the back in 45H with a couple of kids most of the time until I got good enough to afford business class. But that's one of the things, don't you think? A lot of guys come out on tour and they come out of college and they're really accomplished. They've got to learn a lot of things in professional sport. And being able to travel and spend your time away from home in a different hotel room every night and a different pillow every week and different food, it's not easy.
What comes to mind for me is the players now that are making out on the PGA Tour, they're started much, much earlier. The cycle to want to be the best at what they do. And I think it's the PGA Tour, how condensed the schedule has gotten, how competitive the schedule is to be able to keep your card year in, year out. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to ask you from a burnout standpoint and your recollection of what it was like on the PGA Tour when you were playing, and as far as the amount of cards that were available, where the travel schedule went to, as far as just bouncing around to different places. And did you feel like the schedule was maybe laid out better for the professional players to where you wouldn't get quite as burnt out as maybe some of these players get in today's game?
There's so many ideas and thoughts to unpack there for me. If I talk about the first 10 years of my playing, I was playing elsewhere around the world. And in 1988, I wanted to play in the US in 89. So I added four more tournaments to my schedule. I played 40 tournaments in 1988. I was exempt in Europe. I had to play 9 in Europe. I had to play 16 in Japan. I played 10 in Australia. I went and played 4 in the US and the Dunhill Cup. So I played 40 tournaments.
Oh my gosh.
It was 25, 30, yeah. And I always played 36 every year. So people that talk about I'm burnt out, I've played 22 events this year, flying net jets and wheels up. Sorry, don't complain to me about being burnt out.
We got Sungjae Finch over here. Sungjae Baker Finch.
Yeah, exactly. I did what I had to do, and we were playing for a living, and it was just so much difference. Two different worlds. The PGA Tour has condensed their season, which has made it very difficult for the players to play their, say, 20 events in that shortened period, January 1 to mm-hmm. August 30, say. So now you've only got really 8 months to play those events. You've got 4 months where you can go do what you want to do, have an off-season, play a couple of funny season events, travel to Australia for the Australian PGA Championship.
That's right. That's right.
Something, right? But for me, it was I played all the way through the US schedule till it finished, usually end of October. Then I went back and played 10 tournaments in Australia, November, December, January. And I would usually start back at the Genesis in LA, mm. the LA Open, was the last event of the West Coast, or I'd start in Doral, the first event of the East Coast. So I had 4 months off in Australia, and then I came back and played probably 25 events in the US in the next 8 months. Open Championship, Scottish Open maybe as well. I wasn't looking at the start of the year now, and golf is so much more competitive. You know, give all credit to the fact that now there's 5,000 really accomplished young players on both the men's and women's tours around the world. The competitive nature of the game now is so much deeper. Tiger changed that because of the fitness needed and the amount of money that we're playing for. So one tournament in the US is more than our entire schedule in Australia of 16 major tournaments. And then we have 8 or 9 LPGA events in Australia as well. So we play for more money in one tournament. This week, for instance, they're playing for $20 million, I believe.
Yeah.
We don't play for that for the whole year in Australia. So it's, there's so much more money to play for. That's why it's so much more competitive. So I understand all of the people on the teams, you know what it's like. You've been doing it for a decade yourself. You've got to work on when you're up and when you're down. You've got to work on, am I better 3 in a row or 2 week off 2? Then, you know, it's all of this programming through the year. What tournaments am I in? It was a lot easier when they had 125 players exempt. You knew if you were 125th, you could pretty much plan your schedule. I'm not a fan of what they've done, cutting it to 70. Although it's made the Korn Ferry Tour a lot stronger because people are happy to go and start there because they know, what is it, 25 cards?
20 now.
20 now come from there over to the PGA Tour.
10 from the DP, which is...
DP World now. Is it 10 or 15?
You get 10 from the DP for players that aren't already exempt on the PGA Tour.
Yeah. So there's a lot more. It's becoming the World Tour in a way. When I first came over to the US, just another aside, there was probably 20 international players. There was 3 or 4 Australians. Now I think it's 53% international and 47% US born. It's actually
that's
more
interesting stat. I wouldn't have realized that.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. They could hold the President's Cup in Palm Beach, Florida every year because everyone lives here. All the kids go to the same school from both teams. It's funny. The competitive nature and the standard of play is so great now and so much deeper than it was, for sure. That's another reason why there's been a lot of changes throughout the decades.
I can't wrap my head around playing 40 weeks out of the year. I don't know if I like golf that much. I can imagine
that was a crime. It might have been why I burned out early too. You know, I wore myself out. I had to rehab my shoulders. My feet were all locked up. They're sort of like in constant cramp. I had to tape my feet for 3 months, couldn't wear shoes. I had them all separated so I could walk again. Anyway.
You won in 89 at Colonial. Of course, your Open Championship win at Birkdale in 91. one that you always go back and look at, I imagine, with fond memories. But where does your mind take you that week at Birkdale of a specific image or a shot that comes to mind that you just play back in your head thinking, man, I can't believe, you know, what my eyes got to see?
Once again, I could give you a 1 hour answer, but it was a special time in my life. Obviously, I'd been playing very well leading into the Open in 91. I'd just lost in a playoff the week before, 7-hole playoff that I should have won. Some guy Bruce Fleischer, hold a 60-footer on the last hole after he just hold about 5 putts in a row of over 12 feet to stay.
JJ spawned you, huh?
Yeah. How good was he? That was awesome. Gosh. But then I came in feeling like, hey, I've been in the last group of the Open Championship a couple of times before, Saturdays and Sundays. The year before, I was in the last group with Faldo and he won. I really got to see what he did. I came in good form. I basically said to my wife, Jenny, and my caddy, Pete Bender, I just have to keep doing what I've been doing. And as you know, when you go to a major, that's all you really want to do. You want to treat this like another tournament. It's so hard to do because it's a major and you're so amped up for it. But I said, no, I'm going to just do what I normally do. And I tried to keep that mindset. I played well all week. I was, it was a tough golf course. The greens weren't in great shape at Royal Birkdale. And the leading score after 36 holes was 2 under par.
Wow.
So everybody within 10 shots. So everyone at 8 over par or more got in. I think it was like 120 made the cut.
Oh, my goodness.
It was crazy, Smiley. It was the most ever. Fortunately, they cut to 50 after. They went cut to 80, then they cut to 50 back in those days. I was 71-71 the first 2 days. Had played well, but I was 4 back. Saturday, I shot 64, finished eagle birdie. Had the best round of the day, led the tournament going into the last round in the last group with a good friend of mine, Mark O'Meara, who coincidentally went on to win at Royal Birkdale in 1998, having played with me in 91 in the last group. So that was a good, that was fortunate for me to be with a friend that walked fast like I did in the last group. Mm. And I shot 29 the front nine leading. So usually that's a good thing.
Yes.
So I was five in front and I just hit fairways and greens from then on in, two putted every hole. The last hole, I remember I decided, I stood on the last tee and everyone's, if you've played Royal Birkdale, everyone comes up the hill from 17 green and it gets very crowded in there. It's a narrow little pathway through the sand dunes and everyone was coming up onto the tee and I set up and there's so much ruckus behind me. I stood back and I line up again and it's the first time all week I'm lining up down the fairway and I see the out of bounds. There's a picket fence down the right hand side, way right in the gorse. And I'm like, there's a reason I saw that. So I step back and I adjust myself and I aim it down the left rough, left of the bunkers to make sure that I just get it down there. I'm three in front and I hit it in the left rough. I laid up short of the bunkers on around the green with a six iron for my second. And I'm about to pitch it on, probably about a 40-yard pitch. And my caddy, Pete Bender, said, why don't you just run a little eight iron up left of the bunker and two putt for five? And I said to him, Pete, if I can't hit this sand wedge over that bunker and hit a proper chip, I don't deserve to win the Open. So I flipped up a sand wedge out of this, you know, tight lie, you know what they're like over there. Nearly holed it, kind of lipped out, ran on by, two putted for bogey. But that was more my mindset in those days. I knew when I played well, I could win. But the style of player I was more, I was just happy to play the best I could play.
Sure.
And that's really all I ever wanted from myself. If I finished second because I bogeyed the last and Davis Love beat me a couple of times by playing better the last couple of holes than I did, I would just say to myself, hey, I did the best I could do. I'd still do my interview for running second with a smile on my face. I didn't have that killer instinct. So to win the Open the way I did was special to me because obviously it was my goal in life to win the Open Championship. So I achieved that, but I proved to myself that I could win at that level, even though I was always happy just to, you know, do the best I could. And Royal Birkdale was a great golf course to win on. I love going back there each time it's held there. And
it's next year, right? We go to Birkdale
next year. I'll be there for sure.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Special moment and great memories. Obviously my little daughter Haley was two at the time and she had I got this thing here on my mantle. I don't know.
Oh, look at there.
Yeah, that's the claret jug.
That just came out of nowhere.
In the very top, there's a little thing that opens up. And she was so enamored with this thing, this little thing at the top. I don't know if you can see
it. Yeah,
but it opens up. And she was all the time playing with it sort of and looking in there like, what's in this thing, you know? So I had got some great photos and some great memories.
Look at that beauty.
Claret jug.
Best, is that the best trophy in all of golf? Gotta be, right?
I think the guys that win the Masters have a really nice trophy as
that's
well.
That's a good trophy, yeah.
Clubhouse.
That's
this
right.
One, since the Open started in 1860, and they played for a belt for the first 12 years, and the winner, young Tom Morris, he won three in a row. So in those days, when you won something 3 years in a row, you got to keep it. So he got to keep the belt. And then they commissioned this claret jug from 1872. So that jug, well, that's mine. It's a replica, obviously. But the jug's been around since 1872. It's a pretty cool trophy.
God, the title fight belt came from old Tom Morris. Who knew? I had no idea that boxing was taken from the Open Championship. that is so good.
It's a tradition.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Well, yeah, that was a special moment, mate. Thanks for bringing that up. It really means a lot, still does. I take the trophy up to the club each year and in open week if I'm home, let everyone take photos and we pour some good claret in there and drink out of it.
Well, I sure would love to take a stroll with you next year at Royal Birkdale, of course.
Come on over.
Very excited to be there for the Open Championship next year. And I want to just quickly turn the page to, we just came off one of your career highs, obviously winning the Open Championship. This is the high point in your career. Mm-hmm. And take me through to where eventually you lost confidence in the game. Was it physical that led to the mental challenges? Was it did I hear injuries were maybe involved a little bit, shoulder?
Yeah, that was more towards the end. I just wore myself out. It may have started with playing 35 to 40 tournaments every year for 15 years as well. Probably didn't help.
So was there a particular shot that started just showing up out of nowhere that you couldn't figure out?
It didn't happen straight away. In 92, I had a chance to win the Masters, eventually finished sixth. I putted bad the last day. Had a chance to win the US Open at Pebble. I finished second at the Players' Championship. Played pretty well through the US Tour. Finished, I think I was about 15th or 16th. Had finished top 20 at the Open. I played okay, but at the end of the year, I was 24th in the world rankings. And I was so pissed off. I was so angry at myself for having dropped from top 10 down to 24th. I didn't even go to the World Championship of Golf. That was top 25 were invited. I said, no, I don't deserve to be there. I'm not playing. And that was really my mindset. I had let myself down that year, I felt. So in 93, I started trying to change things. What had caused my demise, you know, down to 24th in the world rankings in 92?
So expectations were the beginning.
Exactly right. I look back on it now and think what an idiot I was. And I tried to hit the ball farther, and that changed my swing. I tried to flatten my path, tried to get my wrist this way and get it a little deeper on the way down when I'd always been a cupper. I couldn't miss a fairway if I tried in the old way. It just dripped down left to right about 3 yards every time. And as soon as I tried to change this to this, I lost it.
Me and you both.
Players listening might understand.
I was given that advice as well, and I've quickly figured out over, I say quickly, it's been probably 4 or 5 years of trying to get my left wrist flatter and more flexed, how it didn't work for my body pattern and my shot shape.
And then every once in a while, though, I'd be aiming it down the left, and it would actually drip left instead of dripping right. And I still remember the shot. It was the Australian Open, 8th hole at Metropolitan. Had a 3-wood into the green. I was just trying to hit a high fade in there. I'd won the week before at the Australian PGA Championship. I was playing pretty well, and it drew. And I'm like, oh, where did that come from? I always fade it from there. And that was really the start. And then from then on, I'd hit one or two of those each day. Then it became a bit mental in 94. It'd be on the holes where I saw the white stakes down the left that had happened rather than just at a time, you know, random. And then by 95... I played 15 tournaments in 95 on the PGA Tour. I missed the cut in all 15. No matter what I did, I tried to get myself fit and strong. I was doing everything I could. I couldn't regain my old feelings because I'd kind of lost my own swing. I'd lost what I had in 1991 by that time. I saw so many coaches. I wished I'd gone and seen Butch Harmon. He kept telling me in 96, come see me anytime. I'll look after you. And he's the only one I didn't go to. He was working with Greg, so I didn't feel comfortable. And then Tiger, of course. And then 96, I missed the first 11 in a row. Quit at the British Open in 96 and went home and rehabbed and had myself, you know, 6 months of injury. But that was the sliding door moment, Smiley, to make this a little brief. I struggled for those 2 years, did my absolute best. I still had 5 years exemption. I had a 10-year exemption on the PGA Tour. I just threw 5 years away and said, no, I'm stepping away from the game. And I started doing the television in Australia that year, that summer, and I did 12 events in a row. And that basically was the sliding door moment when I was offered a job over on the PGA Tour with Jack Graham and ABC. After that, a couple of years later when the television contract changed. I did 12 events a year in Australia for a few years and got better at it and good at it. From struggle where it was mental based on me trying to make swing changes, then it became really mental, anguish, anxiety, if you will. Kind of like the yips. Guys get the yips putting and they fear a certain style of putt, whether it be a 45-foot putt up a hill or whether it be the downhill left to righter. You know, whatever it might be in their mind, it's that anxiety level that changes our ability to do what we do so well when we're brain dead. We're just going, you know, we're just so focused. And I lost that ability and that ability to compete.
And did that go away ever? Has it gone away since you got into broadcasting? You know, when you had those 5 to 10 years in broadcasting, was there a time in which you're like, you know what? I feel like my confidence is coming back a little bit, but I found a sense of purpose maybe in broadcasting that is pulling you more towards this versus wanting to continue to chase the competitive game, which, I mean, it doesn't surprise me either. The fact that you played so much golf, it probably was refreshing to get into broadcasting.
In a lot of ways, and the pressure was a lot less, obviously. You understand now you've been doing this for a few years. It's a different style of pressure. Here we are talking to millions of people, hopefully, you know, millions of people on your podcast. But it's a different type of pressure. We're just doing what we're comfortable and what we know. When you're trying to compete and hit a tee shot off the first tee at Augusta National with millions of people watching on TV and thousands of people there in the galleries, when you're doing it well, you're showing off. When you're doing it poorly, you're fearful. And that's the big difference, I think. I'm now, well, obviously it's 30 years on, but I don't have any of that anxiety off the tee anymore. I never miss a fairway. Mind you, I only hit it 250 yards as well. So it's like your 5-iron.
So you're telling me that you're telling me that there's light at the end of the tunnel. That's what to hear.
I figured it out over a couple of years. I went and played the Colonial a couple of times. When in my 40s, I shot 67 the first day one time, and then I was playing really nicely. I was going to make the cut, and I hit a hook on one hole. I think it was the fifth, and made 7 and missed the cut by a couple of shots. So I at least proved to myself that I could still play a little bit at that level. But the security of the job at ABC at that time, and now for the last 20 years, CBS, when I got to 50, I was offered a 4-year extension on my contract. And I said to Jenny, do I give the Champions Tour a go or do I stay with TV? And we decided that it was much better to stay with television, which I did. I was only doing the weekend, so I had more time at home with the family. It's hard when you're on the road constantly.
It sure is. And it's such a fun job broadcasting. And we've had Trevor Immelman on our podcast, and he kind of described it as this, in that you can't replace playing good golf on tour. The money that you make, the feeling that you get of just the satisfaction of working hard and being able to get to a result. But then he kind of put broadcasting right behind that. And it said, broadcasting is way better than playing bad golf. So slotting it right in the middle. He said, you can't, playing bad on tour, there's nothing worse.
Yes. And I did it for 3 straight years. It's not fun. And you feel bad about yourself. I don't think I went through depression, but I was certainly depressed for a couple of years on the way I played. But the best thing, and I think the biggest point that I get to a little bit in my book as well, or Jeff's book, I got through that. And even through that time, I loved golf so much that I still went and played with my buddies on the weekend. I missed every cut. I was father of the year for 2 years. I was home every weekend. I still love to go play golf. And even now, it's not a full day for me. I fit it in when I get a chance, but I'll go have a game of golf with my buddies most days. Just love the game and the challenge, and I'm still trying to get better. My last tournament, I got to call Cam Young winning at the Wyndham Championship, and I learned so much that week watching Cam Young about, even when he was anxious and looking for his first win, he still swung so smooth and so unhurried. And I've turned the corner the last couple of days. I've been swinging like Cam Young, and it's good. I'm enjoying it a little more.
You know, it's so funny. if you don't watch Cam Young swing the golf club and feel that this isn't the right replication of perfect rhythm that you need to probably feel on the range, it's him and Hideki, it's that perfect pause at the top that every golfer can go and watch and learn and try to emulate.
Yeah, 100%. And I even told my wife, Jenny, I said, that's what we've got to work on. You've got to not rush down, just swing it back.
Don't we all? All right. So last thing I want to wrap up here on as we close out this interview, Ian, is you're the perfect person to ask about golf in Australia because mm-hmm. the economics and just the overall logistics of playing professional golf for the PGA Tour to somehow make it over into the hot land of a huge market that clearly LIV Golf has striked gold on with their, I think their best event and their mm-hmm. entire schedule is the one they have in Adelaide. And it's been one that has had incredible crowds and all the players have enjoyed playing there. So tell me why the PGA Tour hasn't made it work to this point and just the overall economics and logistics of mm-hmm. how maybe one day we could make it work. Because clearly it's a place that is deprived of professional golf.
Yes, it is. Once again, a few different angles I could take here, but the first one is I agree with you 100%. The most successful LIV event is in Adelaide, Australia, not just because of Greg Norman, who was running the LIV tournaments, or the young Aussie boys, Cam Smith, Mark Leishman, Matt Jones, Lucas Herbert, being a part of the Aussie team, but just the fact that in the Australians' mind, we've got 50 of the best players in the world, a couple of them perhaps the best in Jon Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, Cam, obviously they love at home. They come and they play. We've been after the PGA Tour for a long time to hold a PGA Tour event in Australia at Royal Melbourne or at Kingston Heath, somewhere in the sand belt of Australia where the golf courses are the best in the world. It's like going out to the Hamptons and playing those wonderful courses at the National Shinnecock. So the problem we face is the time zone, and that is why it's so hard. With US television, the most prolific of all of the sponsorship dollars that come into the PGA Tour, you know, I think it's $750 million a year from television comes in. They don't really want to go to a 16-hour ahead time zone, and so that's really the main reason it hasn't happened, and it's why LIV has prospered so much in Australia, and we're so happy for the Australian team and for them in Adelaide for a successful event, and we try and make sure that we stay connected. But the PGA Tour of Australia, I'm the chairman of the board, we are a pathway tour to the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour. We are joined at the hip. We're PGA Tour's little brother. We're going to do everything we possibly can to get as many Australians onto DP World, eventually onto the PGA Tour. That being said, we also have to be respectful of the LIV players that come and play, and especially our Australian players on LIV, and have them come and play in our tournaments as well and help promote our tour, because we have 20 tournaments on our Australian mm-hmm. tour. Some of them aren't very big, but they go around Australia, the WA Open, the Northern Territory PGA, the New South Wales Open's a big one, over to New Zealand. So we've got so many tournaments to play. But it's really that earning a pathway to the PGA Tour that's the shining light for our players. We've got 300 players that we have to look after, and we will remain a pathway tour to the PGA Tour. We just have to get somehow the Australian PGA Championship or the Australian Open, which will be big this year, Rory McIlroy's playing. We have to get one of those events or an event we make ourselves in the Sandbelt onto the PGA Tour. Let's get a rotation of four or five tournaments outside of the US. You know, I know Scottie Scheffler wants to go home to Dallas every Sunday night, and all of the boys down here in Jupiter, Florida, where I live, they want to go home Sunday nights. They don't really want to travel that much. They have the world's best tour at their back door. But if we could get, you know, we've got the Scottish Open successful. If we had the Spanish Open, for example, or the Australian PGA, the British PGA is a huge tournament, the BMW there. Maybe the Korean Open or the Japan Open, something like that. If we could get four or five extra onto the PGA Tour and turn it into more of a world tour, I think that'd be the ideal step. It'd certainly be good for Australian golf, because as you know, the golf is good in Australia. The courses are remarkable. We always produce good players. You know, look at Adam Scott and Jason Day and Jeff Ogilvy over the years, the players that have come out of there. Anyway, I'm on my soapbox a little
bit.
Well,
you're not wrong at all, and I agree with you 1,000%. We've talked about it in nauseam, how we feel like the fall and the winter, if you're able to go tap into these national opens that we're able to tie in as a It's almost like bonuses for these guys to go and support the game globally, because if you're not able to have it on the PGA Tour schedule, if it was affiliated with the PGA Tour in some way, shape or form, to give guys a pathway that get into this event via Australia, of some of the guys that have been playing on that Australia Asian Tour, if they play well, they have an opportunity to play their way on the PGA Tour. So I think it's a tremendous idea, and I loved playing the Australian Open and the Australian PGA. I enjoyed my time down there. Francie and I still talk about it, and we want to go back. That's how much fun we had.
Yeah, come on. We'll jump on it. We'll do a little cameo on TV for half an hour while you're there. We'd love to have you come play.
Oh, man, it's just tremendous. We played it, gosh, it was at the Australian Golf Club in Sydney, and it was there were some bad fires, so there was a bunch of smoke they were dealing with that week. But then the other golf course, the one they played at the Australian PGA for years, I'm not sure the name.
Was it on
the Gold Coast?
Royal Pines on the Gold Coast?
Yes, that's right.
Now it's played there too. Queensland. It's at a real royal course now. It's a beautiful event up in Brisbane.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it was, and I know you're going to be a huge advocate to hopefully having the PGA Tour affiliated with an event down there. And I know you'll help lead the charge, because
hope so.
I know it's a 16-hour difference, but I still will watch.
I know. When I used to do the TV for the Australian tournaments, it had always come back on the Golf Channel. And people in the States would love it. The time it came on was sort of evening time, and the courses looked so good. And I think it'd work. Even if we just did it once a year, and the players could maybe do somewhere in Asia at the same time, Singapore or Japan or somewhere on that time zone. Yeah, we could certainly make it work. So let's work on it.
Let's work on it, Ian. And we appreciate your time today. And of course, if you want to go check out Ian Baker's book that has recently come out here in the States on August 5th, To Hell and Back, go check it out. I'm sure you can Google it. Go check it out on Amazon. Give it a read, as I will also be doing very soon. So, Ian, we appreciate your time. And of course, congrats on an incredible broadcasting career.
Thanks a lot, Smiley. You keep up the great work, my friend.
Thank you, Ian.
You carry the banner for me for the next three decades.
Oh, gosh, I hope so. if I could have half the success that you've had in broadcasting, I would consider it a great career. So, Ian, see you soon, my friend.
Thank you very much, Smiley. Cheers, bud.
Cheers.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our first level time. Fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people at YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the